These three, Torah, temple service, and loving kindness, emphasize for this sage what is even more foundational than the symbols of Greece in Rembrandt's painting: politics, art, and philosophy. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 35, Alexander and the High Priest. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. Towering over Athens is the Acropolis, with the Parthenon of Pericles gleaming in the sun, symbol of Greek art and culture for thousands of years. 300 yards away sits the Acropolis Museum, containing within it the antiquities discovered on and around that site over the millennia. And perhaps the true embodiment of all its history within that collection is a bust of Alexander the Great. Alexander was not a philosopher or a pagan priest or a sculptor or a scientist or an artist or an architect or even an Athenian. But ultimately, he is why we care about Athens at all, because it is through Alexander that what was once a small city-state changed human history. The fact that Alexander achieved the vast empire is in itself neither here nor there. We have, in our journey through Jewish history, met other kings and conquerors that bestrode the world. But Alexander was different because he was an evangelist for Greek culture and achievement. He conquered not only to amass territory, but to Hellenize it. And therefore, for all its beauty and grandeur, the glory of Greece was bound to exist in tension and at times open conflict with one tiny people who believed that it had been called by God to hold themselves a people apart, changing the world while proclaiming that it served as witnesses to the one true God. This, of course, is the Jewish people. At the same time, according to Jewish tradition, the beginning of the encounter between Alexander and the Jews, between Greece and the Jews, between Athens and Jerusalem, was not a negative one. And this story, found both in Talmudic texts and other Jewish records, highlights the complexity of the Jewish interaction with the intellectual heritage of Greece, one which will, from this moment on, so profoundly impact the story that we tell. It is in 336 BCE that Alexander the Macedonian's campaign begins, and in 332 that he arrives at the gates of Jerusalem. For the Babylonian Talmud, the leader of Jewish Jerusalem at this moment is the high priest Simeon the Righteous, or Simon the Just, who, as we mentioned in our previous presentation, was the last living member of the Great Assembly. Simon, the Talmud tells us, went forth from Jerusalem to greet the Greek conqueror. Here is one translation of part of the Talmudic description of what unfolded, a description that occurs as part of a larger story. He, meaning Simon, robed himself in priestly garments. Some of the noblemen of Israel went with him, carrying fiery torches in their hands. They walked all the night, some walking on one side and others on the other side, until the dawn rose. We must ponder the literary symbolism here. Alexander believes that he is bringing Greek enlightenment. But Simon, illumined by torches and by the very dawn, embodies the light of Jewish wisdom and of the Torah. The Talmudic story continues, describing the encounter between Simeon and Alexander. When he saw Simeon the Just, he descended from his carriage and bowed down before him. They said to him, "A great king like yourself should bow down before this Jew?" He answered, "His image it is which wins for me in all my battles." By this, Alexander means that he saw an image of Simeon in his dreams before every successful military encounter, and he therefore accorded honor to the high priest. Thus, the Talmud tells us, was Alexander's meeting with Simeon one which ended well for Jerusalem. Now, fascinatingly, a parallel version of this Talmudic tale appears in a very non-rabbinic text, the Antiquities of Josephus, who gives us a different high priest in the story, but nevertheless a very similar account. In Josephus' version, after Alexander bows to the high priest, a Greek noble wonders at what his leader has done. Josephus writes, "However, Parmenion alone went up to him and asked him how it came to pass that when all others adored him, he, meaning Alexander, should adore the high priest of the Jews, to whom he replied, 'I do not adore him, but that God who has honored him with his high priesthood. For I saw this very person in a dream in this very habit when I was at Dion in Macedonia, who, when I was considering with myself how I might obtain the dominion of Asia, exhorted me to make no delay, but boldly to pass over the sea thither, for that he would conduct my army and would give me the dominion over the Persians. Whence it is that, having seen no other in that habit, and now seeing this person in it, and remembering that vision and the exhortation which I had in my dream, I believe that I bring this army under the divine conduct, and shall therewith conquer Darius, and destroy the power of the Persians, and that all things will succeed according to what is in my own mind. And when he had said this to Parmenion and had given the high priest his right hand, the priest ran along by him and he came into the city. And when he went up into the temple, he offered sacrifice to God according to the high priest's direction and magnificently treated both the high priest and the priests. Thus, in Josephus's version, does the high priest enter Jerusalem. Josephus further adds that the Jews showed sacred scripture to the Greek ruler, highlighting how Daniel himself, in Revelation, predicted the downfall of Persia and its conquest at the hands of another empire. Josephus writes, "And when the book of Daniel was showed him, wherein Daniel declared that one of the Greeks should destroy the empire of the Persians, he supposed that himself was the person intended. And as he was then glad, he dismissed the multitude for the present. But the next day he called them to him and bid them ask what favors they pleased of him. Whereupon the high priest desired that they might enjoy the laws of their forefathers and might pay no tribute on the seventh year. He granted all they desired. And when they asked him that he would permit the Jews in Babylon and Media to enjoy their own laws also, he willingly promised to do hereafter what they desired." Thus, in Josephus's story, is religious freedom achieved, at least for now, in Jerusalem and in all of Alexander's empire. The differences notwithstanding, the additional details of Josephus' account complement the Talmudic one. The Talmudic attitude to Alexander in general and to Greece in general is complex, and it is best not to caricature it. There is no question that the rabbis understood the greatness of Greek achievement. But at the same time, even if they had never visited Athens or viewed the Parthenon gleaming atop the Acropolis, the rabbis understood the ethos of a city that would place at its summit a temple to Athena, who was worshipped as a patron goddess. Even if so much of Athenian intellectual achievement was achieved not at that site, but rather in the surrounding city, and especially in the grove that was Plato's academy, nevertheless, the high point of Athens, still the symbol of that city today, celebrated in paganism a worldview that was very much in variance with biblical monotheism. As Rabbi Jonathan Sacks once put it, the Greeks believed in the holiness of beauty, whereas the Jews insisted instead upon the beauty of holiness. We speak often of this conflict as Jerusalem versus Athens, a difference in approach that was well understood by the Jews at the dawn of the Hellenistic era. And the rabbis believed that because of biblical revelation, Jerusalem had exceeded Athens in wisdom. In this vein, it's worth reflecting on one of the most famous depictions of Greek achievement in the history of Western art, one which also references Alexander himself, though this might be missed at times. I refer to Rembrandt's painting, known as Aristotle Contemplating the Bust of Homer. We have sent you a link to the work of art, but I would note that it usually hangs in the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. I visit it often, and I recommend that when you are in the city, you take the opportunity to go see it. As he does so often, Rembrandt here is utilizing hands to signify tension. We see Aristotle with one hand touching the bust of Homer, the greatest of Greek poets. Homer was blind, and Aristotle looking at him is pondering the deep sight or insight with which Homer was blessed. But with the other hand, Aristotle is touching a golden chain that hangs around his neck. And if we look carefully at the pendant upon it, we will see the small profile of Alexander, a sign of the favor of the sovereign. For Aristotle was Alexander's teacher, and Rembrandt depicts the philosopher pondering here whether he has made the right choice to leave the realm of free inquiry for the halls of power and influence. And the painting in its complexity gives us three different achievements of Greece: art or literature, embodied by Homer, philosophy, represented by Aristotle, and politics, symbolized by Alexander. Meanwhile, Simeon the Righteous, Alexander's interlocutor in the Talmud, leaves us with the following maxim as his epitaph: "The world stands on three things, on the Torah, on the temple service, and on acts of loving kindness." If Simeon the Righteous marks the moment for the Talmud when the Jewish engagement with Greece begins, then it is worth noting that these three, Torah, temple service, and loving kindness, emphasize for this sage what is even more foundational than the symbols of Greece in Rembrandt's painting: politics, art, and philosophy. What was so central for Simeon the Righteous? Loving kindness, or loyal love. For politics is important, but politics must be founded on morality. The temple service, for the achievements of art, can be incredible, but for Judaism, beauty is made manifest first and foremost in the holiness of Jerusalem. And finally, first and foremost, the Torah. For while philosophy can be a source of wisdom, Jews believe that it is revelation, above all, in which wisdom is to be sought. Perhaps the most eloquent expression of this point was made in the modern era, not by a Jew, but by the best educated man in American history, John Quincy Adams, who wrote a series of letters about religion to his son in America, George Washington Adams. I will cite several selections. John Quincy wrote, "The existence of a creator, the immortality of the human soul, and the future state of retribution are therefore so perfectly congenial to natural reason that once discovered, or rather it is so impossible for natural reason to disbelieve them, that it would seem the light of natural reason would alone suffice for their discovery. But this conclusion would not be exact. Human reason may be sufficient to get an obscure glimpse at these sacred and important truths, but it cannot discover them in all their clearness." And Adams adds, "Almost all the Greek philosophers reasoned and meditated upon the nature of the gods, but scarcely any of them ever reflected enough even to imagine that there was but one God, and not one of them ever conceived of him as the creator of the world. Thus far, no farther," Adams further writes, "could human reason extend, but the first words of the Bible are, 'In the beginning God created the heaven and the earth.' This blessed and sublime idea of God, the creator of the universe, the source of all human virtue and all human happiness, for which all the sages and philosophers of Greece and Rome groped in darkness and never found, is revealed in the first verse of the book of Genesis." End quote. The holiness of beauty versus the beauty of holiness. Philosophy versus Torah. Greek politics versus biblical ethics. Jerusalem may have been spared and even treated reverently by Alexander the Great, but Athens and Jerusalem still are different, and the stage is now set for the clash between Judaism and Hellenism. As the events unfold, we will see how the light embodied by the torches and dawn of Simeon the righteous will, in one moment, be seemingly snuffed out and then resurrected in achievements that will be remembered in candle lightings by Jews to this day. This is Meir Soloveitchik. Looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.